Company of Makers, podcast, talks, workshops.
We are here because for the first time for many years, British sovereign territory has been invaded by a foreign power.
The task force, with all its power, is ready. Britain has gathered its might. It must set its course.
I'm not allowed to say how many planes joined the raid, but I counted them all out, and I counted them all back.
We're now between the two gun lines, and there's a right old artillery duel going on between them.
There is a white flag flying over Stanley. Very marvellous.
Welcome to Land, Sea and Air, Stories from the Armed Forces. In this series, we hear untold stories from the Falklands War, 40 years on. This is the story of the conflict, told by eight different people who were actually there.
Hi, Steve. I'm really excited about this new series, focusing on the Falklands conflict of 40 years ago. And I understand that you've got an interview with one of the Royal Marines that was part of the Royal Marine Detachment on the islands at the time of the invasion.
I have indeed, Mike, none other than Ray Bloy of Naval Party 8901.
Naval Party 8901, there's a number that rings bells. Okay, let's hear it then.
Yes, this is quite a story indeed. Ray, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast.
You're more than welcome.
So, NP 8901, if I've got that correct, I hope I've got that right. You can tell I've been rehearsing that in my head. I think there's a bit of a story here in terms of there's a few things that might need to be corrected, do you think?
Oh, just a little bit, yeah. We've been banging our heads against a brick wall for the last 40 years, trying to get the truth told about what happened on the day that it all kicked off, 2nd of April 1982.
And you've had more than one opportunity to correct that because you've recently been featured in a TV programme, which is also good news, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Ben Fogle presented a great programme. I think there could have possibly been a little bit more about our actual fight, but nevertheless, he certainly got our story out there that we didn't just surrender, as the popular story goes.
No, the shameful headlines, but we will come on to that, I'm absolutely sure. So absolutely. I think you're probably one of the few people I don't need to ask where the Falklands is before they went down there, because that's exactly where you were, isn't it? So what's the story and what's the purpose of the Naval Party?
We've been there, personally, I've been there for the whole year leading up to the war or conflict, as some people like to call it. The purpose there was to have a military presence on the island because of all the saber rattling by the Argentinians. For as long as going back in history, there's always been a military presence of some sort in the Falklands. But in earnest, I think, certainly for the last sort of 20, 30 years before my time there, we'd had a regular detachment such as ours.
Okay.
That was the purpose.
So did you realise there was an impending invasion coming? Did you realise that a war was about to start? And if so, how much warning did you get?
Well, obviously, there was always the possibility. We had been briefed to the effect that the Argentinians wanted it. Obviously, we weren't stupid. We'd had numerous incidents where the Argentinian Air Force was flying over and doing touch-and-go takeoffs on the airport. Clearly in preparation for, if they ever came in. But as for actually knowing, we were basically put on a heightened state of readiness from the 19th of March when the scrap metal merchants went into South Georgia. Mm. So that was when things started to get a bit sort of edgy, if you like.
So how did you prepare? What was the plan? Because there wasn't exactly a lot of you, was there?
No. I mean, our normal complement was 44. Two officers, a major and a lieutenant. Then the rest of us, sergeant, major, sergeants, etc., all the way down. So 44 was a normal complement. We at that time, on the 19th, obviously, it was decided that HMS Sejuris was down in the area at the time. They had 13 Royal Marines on board, their detachment. Obviously, they didn't deem that enough, so we gave them a section of ours. So another 9 of ours went on endurance and went down to South Georgia to basically kick off the scrap metal merchants. And so that left us fairly well short. As you said, we'd been there a whole year, so we were coming up to our handover anyway to the 82, 83 detachment. But at the time, we were vastly reduced, if you like. A couple of our number had already gone back to the UK, handed over to their successors, people like the chef, BW, a couple of others. So we didn't have that many people. Trying to think now. Got to hold that there for a second because I've lost
that's
the train
okay.
of thought.
That's all right. You carry on. You carry on. So you just said that you didn't have that many numbers there because you were depleted. And then what happened next?
Yeah. So anyway, with the endurance being down further down south than what we were, obviously, the new detachment had nowhere coming or getting to the Falklands because our usual route was we'd transit from the UK down to Montevideo, and where the endurance would collect the new detachment and bring them to us. That wasn't going to happen this year. So what did happen was the Antarctic survey ship, the John Biscoe, did us a favour basically and brought Mike Norman's detachment to the islands. They got there about 3 days before the 2nd of April. So we actually had more than the normal 44, but less than 2 whole detachments.
So when did things start to get serious on the Falkland Islands then for you guys?
It was pretty much from the time that, in fact, I think it was the day before Mike Norman's detachment arrived. But myself, Nick Williams, who was our chippy, our carpenter, he was a corporal, and I believe it was Tel George, we were tasked with going up to Cape Pembroke Lighthouse. And we basically spent 3 days up there and nights on lookout for potential, you know, periscopes. I'm not sure how they actually thought we could spot a periscope from a lighthouse like that. But obviously, more importantly, any ships coming our way. We didn't really have any radar, and certainly satellite weren't really a biggie back in those days. But what we did have was the MV Forest that did have its own radar. But that's the best we had. So we were on standby, if you like, for 3 days. And that's when we were starting to get a bit edgy. And of course, the day before the invasion, anybody would think, April Fool's Day. I mean, come on. if we hadn't have been so serious, obviously we would have thought a bit less of it. And, you know, this is a bit of a wind up for the new detachment coming in. But with things that had already gone on, i.e. South Georgia, sending people down there, I think that'd be a bit extreme for an April Fool's Day joke. Yeah. So we didn't take it like that at all. But obviously, this is the 1st of April was the real wake-up call, if you like, because that was when the bosses got the call saying the RGs have made the set sail, if you like, and are on their way. The infamous words now, make your dispositions accordingly, no help coming. And talking to Mike Norman only very recently at our reunion, he was saying there was no good luck on the end of that. Just get on with it and you're on your own.
That's quite a phrase, isn't it? Make your dispositions accordingly. That's like really absolutely helpful, is it? Or am I just misunderstanding that?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, obviously, contingencies had been planned for many years, and ours was no less. Gareth Newt, our boss, had obviously reviewed the plans. Mike Norman reviewed them again, although he didn't have very much time. And I'm not sure, obviously, I was not one of the in crowd, if you like, being a basic grav. I wouldn't have known any of the planning and stuff like that going on behind the scenes. I just did what I was told, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But the contingencies were there. And so we put into place one of those contingencies. The fact that we had more numbers is obviously beneficial, because at the end of the day, though, it ended up with 68 of us. That's not really going to keep an invasion force out of a small island like that. Even with the help of the FIDF, I think they had around about 60 on their books, but 22 turned out that night.
That's the Falklands Defence Force, isn't it?
It is, the Falkland Island Defence Force, FIDF. And whilst, you know, when you look back, they didn't really get into the action. The fact that they turned out, I've got to commend every single one of them, you know, the brave men, you know, like us, we were there. We had no option. They did have an option. They didn't really have to turn out, you know, put their lives on the line. So all credit to them.
Yeah. So you were obviously, I guess, assigned certain tasks. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that and, you know, what happened afterwards and how it all ensued?
Absolutely. The idea was to set up a collapsing defence. The obvious route we thought that they would invade would be by landing craft up at York Bay, which was a nice big wide stretch of beach, beautiful beach, sloping sands, so ideal for landing craft. Hindsight is a wonderful thing. Nobody actually told us they had Amtraks, so they didn't need a nice sloping beach for the landing craft.
So do you want to just explain for our listeners what an Amtrak is? Because not everybody's going to know.
Yeah, it's an armoured vehicle. So it's wheels that is capable of travelling on water. So it's an amphibious truck, if you like, or armoured vehicle. I believe it was either a 20 or 30 millimetre cannon on board, one of those things. So it could do a lot of damage. I believe they can also carry about 20 people, fully armed troops inside. So our initial thing was we had two guys up at York Bay in the sand dunes with a GPMG. The idea was for them to give a belt of 200 or more, if they could, into the first landing craft up the beach and then retreat. Their route out was back off from the dunes to where they had a canoe, where they would paddle across a small stretch of water, where they had two motorbikes waiting for them to come back in towards Stanley. Obviously, as I've said, the Amtraks blew the York Bay landing craft scenario completely out of the water, and they landed on the beach. Other than that, and obviously that defence was completely, you know, useless. So Jock Wilcox was the guy on the gun. He was one of our snipers that we had out there. And Les Milne was the other chap. And they quite rightly decided they're not going to take on Amtraks with the GPMG. So they beat a hasty retreat. We then had another section out by the airport and they would have engaged. But before any of this could actually happen, the invasion started elsewhere. What we'd actually thought, and that was our contingency, the plans were that we thought they would come in from the airport direction. Well, they didn't do that. So one of the contingencies that wasn't planned for was for them to actually come in and take out the Brook first. Moody Brook was our barracks that we'd been living in for the past year. My particular section, I was allocated number 6 section, and our position was at Murray Heights, which was to the south of the town. And it was identified as a potential helicopter landing zone.
Mm-hmm.
So I, with our 6, we had the Scouse Carr, who was the section corporal, PW, Nick Williams, who I said, our chippy, he was number 2 on the gun to Benny Bennett. And there was 3 of us as riflemen, me, Tel George, and George Carr. So that was our 6. And we got up there, done little shell scrapes, well, a bit more than a shell scrape, but not quite a trench, and prepared for the wait. So about 3 o'clock in the morning, the first thing that we realised, because up until this point, we didn't, there were all sorts of scenarios going through our heads for that. Yes, we knew they were coming, but we didn't know that they were actually going to physically land. They might have just sort of stuck off the Cape Pembroke and said, look, we're here, give up, we're going to come in. So we didn't know exactly what they were going to do. But 3 o'clock, roughly 3 o'clock, we heard helicopters to the north of us. It seemed like the north. It was a very still, calm night. And we could hear the choppers coming in. I've heard many times over the years that the noises we heard were Geminis stuck in kelp and stuff like that. I think I know the difference between the sound of a helicopter and the sound of a boat stuck in kelp. There were definitely helicopters.
Yep.
But anyway, shortly after this, all hell seems to break loose from the direction of Moody Brook. Lots of explosions, lots of small arms fire, and they've basically taken out the brook, absolutely destroyed it. They went through every room, throwing grenades through the windows, followed up by small arms fire, believing we were in our beds, tucked up nice and asleep.
Mm.
So the idea, again, one of the things I've heard many times over the years is that they weren't trying to kill us. They were using blanks. Anybody that had seen the brook after that night would know. Mm. They would not. They were definitely trying to take us out. So that was the first thing that had gone awry, if you like, because that was not part of the contingencies we had to take out the brook. And the next thing, because of these, if you like, the way that they've knackered our contingency, the boss said, had a rethink and I'm getting my tongue all tied up here. Sorry about this.
That's all right. Don't worry. So what we're talking about here is no plan survives first contact with the enemy. I've had that so many times. I think this is living testament to that, isn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's a spot on quote, that one, I think. Yeah.
So I guess the bosses got together and thought, right, we're going to have a bit of a different plan here.
Yeah. So the collapsing defence has really gone out the window. So because they're coming from a different direction. So the order comes across. I don't know how we got the order because our radios were so unreliable. if you wanted to transmit back to the UK, they were great for that. But just line of sight stuff down there, they were awful. We'd have been better off with some of the locals, sort of CB radios, I think.
Yep.
But anyway, I think they were Raycalls, if I remember rightly. Anyway, we got the message to retreat back to Government House to make strong defence there. So that's what we started to do. In the meantime, they've landed not at York Bay, but at another beach. So they are also coming in from that direction in Amtrak's. So the section, having got the word to head back to Government House, did just that. They threw all their guns and ammo into Land Rovers and headed back. There was another section out at White City, which is the edge of Stanley, as it was back then. They were there waiting with some 84 or an 84 and some 66s. They engaged the first Amtraks that came along and took out the leading Amtrak with an 84 and a 66. And they tell me, and I've no reason to doubt them, that nobody got out of that leading Amtrak.
Mm.
So that was one of the first contacts. My section, as I say, we were ordered back. And at the start of this, the adrenaline starts to kick in a little bit. And one of the things, you know, if you've spoken to other Royal Marines, one of the most coveted things we've got is our Green Beret.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I don't want to lose this. I took it off and stuck it down my windproof so that I didn't lose it. I was armed with carrying so much ammunition. We'd been issued 5 magazines each for our SLRs. And once everybody had been given that ammunition, we were basically told to help ourselves from the ammo stores. So I'd had another 300 rounds in bandoliers. I had 2 bin line or bin liners of GPMG ammunition. So another 400 rounds there, two 66s, anti-tank rockets, a couple of HE grenades, a couple of white phos grenades, plus all my fighting, you know, my fighting order. So had a good bit of stuff. So as I say, I didn't really want to lose my Green Beret. We start making our way down through the town, and we thought the best way is to go down onto the Ross Road, which is the road that leads, runs along the front of the harbour and off to Government House. So we're going down and we're heading up, and we've come by the, I think they were known as the legislative buildings. It's the government offices on the Ross Road, and it has a grass bank out front outside of it. I've got ahead of myself a little bit, because by this time, Government House is under fire. So there's a lot of firing going on at Government House. This is obviously where the arches have come up from the brook direction. So we've got to these government buildings, and once you get past there, you've got an open ground. There's a football pitch and just other open ground, and then you've got Government House. As we've come out from underneath this grass bank, we get opened up on by the RGs in the hills over, or the rocks over Government House. And we thought, that doesn't sound very good.
So, is that exactly what you thought? Yeah, imagine how that really went.
Yeah, the crack of the rounds, you know, anybody that's been in the butts of a rifle range knows that it's a hell of a crack that goes over your head with a high velocity.
Yeah.
And these loud cracks were very close. And having taken my beret off, I thought, oh, Christ, I better put my beret on. And it's just psychological. I know that. Because obviously it's a little bit of cloth. I put my Green Beret on and I felt so much better again.
It's that invincible green lid, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's bulletproof. Absolutely. Yeah. Not just the lid. It's a, yeah. Anyway, it was psychological, and I put my Green Beret back on. I thought, right, now I'm ready. So we turned a bit of fire. And we thought, there's no chance of us getting across that open ground. So let's go back and up through the town and try and get round over the top of them. So we move back and we go back as far as, I believe it's Barrack Street, which is a road that goes up. So we go up there and we get to St. Mary's Walk, I believe it is. And we thought, okay, we'll try this one. So we're a little bit up in the town now. But almost immediately we started along St. Mary's Walk. We come under heavy Argentine fire again. There was a corrugated iron fence on my right-hand side. And whilst I'm not a mad fan of some of the things they get up to in Hollywood films, but I could actually see the splash marks sort of heading my way in the road. And I thought there was just nowhere for me to go. And opposite me was a picket fence with a couple of slats missing from it. And I thought, I'm going for that gap in the fence. So I didn't know how I was going to get through it, because I know I was a bit slimmer than I am now back then. and I was a lot fitter as well. But I thought, I'm going for that gap. With all the kit I was carrying, I knew I wasn't going to get over the fence. So I was going to go for this little gap, and I was going to dive through this gap. And I had it all in my mind. I was going to roll and come up into a nice firing position and put down the rounds, just like they used to do on The Professionals, Bodie and Doyle. And anyway, I went for this gap, because as I say, the rounds were coming down, they're coming our way. So I ran and I dove and I rolled and I came up firing. And I thought, I actually went through my mind, I thought it worked whilst I'm putting down rounds. And of course, whilst I was doing that, I was putting down the covering fire. The lads came over and they all came in, and we were sort of hidden by a couple of buildings. Well, I always wondered how I got through this little gap. And it was actually, sadly, over 30 years later, a wake of one of our guys going through, as you do, swing the lamp. And I related related this story again and tell George, said, no, he said, you got it right as such. He said, but you didn't get through that gap. He said, you took the fence down. I thought, okay, well, that explains how I got through this little gap. I didn't. So anyway, it was something amusing to look back on, but wasn't quite so amusing at the time. We've carried on up towards Allardyce Street from there. And again, another corrugated iron fence. And again, the rounds were coming our way. So every road we were basically trying to go down, we were cut off. There seemed to be no way out. So, as I say, Allardyce Street, another corrugated iron fence. I've had to hit the deck again because I had nowhere. There was no fence for me to go over this time, just a building, a house. So I've had all I could do was hit the deck. And all of a sudden, bang, 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 you know, just above my head, a line of holes appeared in this corrugated iron fence. And again, for more than 30 years, I always wondered how close these really were. Mm. Well, I went back to the Falklands in 2015. And amazingly, I managed to find that same fence and those holes are still there. So wow. I laid down in front of it and I thought, yep, they were that close. That was amazing. I mean, that actually featured on that program with Ben Fogle recently. Yep. So my fence is still there. As Benny was putting down the rounds, there was a post box on the corner of King Street and Allardyce Street, and Benny had the gun up on there and he was putting down colossal fire. I don't know, he put down several hundred rounds, and Nick kept that gun fed. He just seemed to magic the belts up from somewhere, because I was in really wanting to get rid of my ammo to him, because it was obviously extra weight for me. But every time I offered him my 200 rounds of belt ammo, he already had some. I had to persist in carrying it all round. By this time, we're fairly well up the town, and there's just no route back. So we thought, if we can get back down to the MV Forest, which was a cargo boat, a 70-foot boat, which was used by the government to take supplies out and collect wool, and used to take us around the islands as well throughout our year's tour down there. And we had a good rapport with the skipper, Jack Solis. And we thought, if we can get down there, we can try and get across the harbour and a way into the hills then. One of the contingencies that was planned for, that if it looked likely that, you know, obviously we'd be taken, was to try and escape into the hills to fight a guerrilla warfare. Our detachment had been scouring the hill, the countryside, the hills, and we'd managed to locate a number of caves where we could take shelter and maybe fight a guerrilla warfare from. The new detachment obviously didn't have this knowledge. So we thought, if we can get down, get across the harbour, there might be a route out. It probably wasn't, because obviously at that point, the brook had been taken out. We didn't know if there was anybody left in that area.
Mm.
So we get back down to, or head back down towards the forest. And another amusing incident happened en route back down, because again, we're under fire and we're putting down the rounds. We're in the middle of a big firefight, where all of a sudden a front door opens of this house opposite us. And we all swing around and expecting an Argy there. And it's the lady of the house asking us if her Land Rover is in the way. Excuse me, is my Land Rover in the way? She called. We just shouted all shouted at the same time, get back inside and stay away from the windows. Most of the houses were wooden down there at the time.
Mm.
So, oh boy. That happened with my section. And I know for a fact one of the other sections had a similar incident, but they were even actually offered a cup of tea during their firefight.
Oh.
I think the islanders, whilst they knew it was real, I don't know. Maybe they thought it was still a bit of an exercise.
It's a very British thing, isn't it? A cup of tea to solve any problem, including bullets.
Absolutely. You know, so yeah, there was some funny little incidents. I suppose that happens in any warfare. Mm. You know, whilst it's serious, there are some incidents that you can look back on with a bit of amusement.
Mm.
And so we're doing that. And again, very near that time, I've had a little incident with a member of the FIDF as we're walking along, you know, moving down to the boat. From underneath this hedge, a rifle, a barrel appears. And again, we know the Argies are in the town by this point because we're fighting them. And I swing around and this FIDF head suddenly appears. "Don't shoot, don't shoot." I said, "What are you doing down there?" He said, "I've got separated from my section." He said, "I don't know what to do." We just said, you're better off going home, mate. So don't know what actually happened to him or who he was, but very close to shooting one of my own there. Mm. And that was a bit of a frightening experience. So anyway, we get back down to Ross Road and we come out around the area of the police station and opposite the by the post office. At this point, we know that the APCs are coming into the town. So me having the 66s, I cross the road by the post office and prepare a 66 because we believed that they were going to be coming along Ross Road from the direction of the Globe Hotel, Philomel Street. And we're preparing there and waiting and we can hear shooting and everything going on. And at some point we could hear screaming coming from the direction of Government House. And all we were thinking was, "God, I hope that's not one of ours." It turned out it was the Argentine chap called Giacchino, I think his name, he's the only person that they actually admit having had killed during the invasion. But he was screaming his head off. But we didn't know because there was no talking or anything like that. It was just screams. So this was going on. Meanwhile, along Ross Road, before the APCs have come our way, we see a chap walking along the road, lunchbox under his arm. And as he gets closer, we yell, "Get off the road." And he says, "It's all right for you. Some of us have got to get to work." Oh, boy, you can't make that up. There was a film going back in the 90s, I think it was, An Ungentlemanly Act. This incident is actually portrayed in there. And I believe the chap's name was Henry Halliday.
Mm-hmm.
And he was basically grabbed. One of the police officers came out. I saw it. It was Anton Livermore, a really nice guy. He came running out, grabbed this Henry and dragged him back in. The film, Ungentlemanly Act, shows it as the inspector or the chief of police down there. Lamb is doing it, but it never saw him. It was Anton Livermore grabbed this chap. Very brave because, again, had the potential for the Argies to be there. So, anyway, he was dragged in. We're waiting and waiting, and we suddenly realised this was a bit of a wake-up. Him coming along actually probably jogged our thoughts a little bit. We thought, there are civvies here. We've got to be a little bit careful of what we do.
Mm.
As I said, most of the buildings were made of wood. And a 7.62 is easily going to go through there. So a 66 or an 84 is going to do a lot more damage. Whilst they're a decent weapon, they're not the most accurate and they're not the most reliable, if you like. And we thought, if we fire an APC and it takes a ricochet and goes off into one of the buildings, we could not justify that. So we thought, nah, it's not going to happen. So that was one of the most frightening things because I'd obviously done the drills to open and collapse 66s, but I'd never done it with a live one before. You'd either thrown it away by that point or you'd only used the drill 66. So collapsing it was a bit iffy, but, you do your job. you follow the instructions and it's all good. But I didn't really want to do it again, not collapse one. And then we start to think, right, we're going to get back to plan A or plan B. Well, I'm not sure which plan we're on by this time, actually. So get back to the forest and see if we can get across. So up we go again. And it's only a short jetty out to the forest. It's probably 50, 60 yards long. But by the time we got there, as I say, we'd taken an awful lot of fire. And, I'd taken on a number of targets. I don't know if I hit any of them. Some of them went down when I fired at them. But they could just have been taking cover, or I may have hit some. I'll never know. And we're at the jump-off point before going out to the jetty. And I think Benny... Oh, by this point, sorry, I've forgotten a little incident. In the two chaps that were at the beach coming back on their motorbikes, we actually intercepted them at some point in our sort of running firefights, because we thought we don't want them running out or driving out into the open ground between the town and the government building, government house. So we flagged them down, and they decided to join our section. So we've now got eight in our team, and we're heading to the forest, and they're putting the rounds down, covering us, and us riflemen run out to the walls of the forest. That was the longest 50 yards of my life. It's like the old dreams where you're running in quicksand and you're not getting anywhere. That's what that seemed like. Anyway, we got there and reciprocated, put the covering fire down, and they came out. We got onto the forest. I wasn't aware at the time, but apparently Nick and Scouse asked Jack Solis if he would actually take us out round the through the Narrows so that we could escape into the hills or the camp, as it was known, that way. Quite rightly, Jack Solis said no. He's not going to put his ship in danger, let alone his crew. And quite rightly, he said no. But he obviously said, you can have our Gemini that carried on board. And if you want to use that and get across, you're welcome to it. So we got it overboard, and we started to try and get into the boat. And Benny was quite good with the engines and stuff like that. He worked on them, and he was trying to get the damn thing started. And no way, this engine just refused to start. Whether it was the engine or the fuel or something academic, we couldn't get it to start. So we thought, okay, it's a big risk, and in hindsight, suicidal, but we thought we'll paddle across. At least we can get over. It's about 800 yards wide at that point. And we just thought we didn't want to get captured. All right. Of all the scenarios from when I first joined the Marines, not one of them entailed me becoming a prisoner of war. I just never wasn't an option. Anyway, we're piling into this Gemini, and most of us have got in. I think certainly five or six of us got into this blooming thing. And at that point, the first Pecara flies over straight up the harbour. And we thought, with those up, we've got absolutely no chance of getting across.
Mm.
As I say, really thinking about it, the argies in the rocks of our government house, they could have easily have taken us out had we got out from the side of the forest. But we were prepared to give that a go. But with the Pecaras up, we thought, that's just not going to happen. And it was pretty much at that point that word came over that Rex Hunt was telling us to stop fighting. Now, this is another big issue that we've had for the last 40 years, where it's always said the Marines surrendered. And there was no surrender involved. Rex Hunt called a truce, and he basically told us to stop fighting and lay our weapons down, but no surrender. I know it's semantics, really, but for, you know, we can hold our heads up. We didn't actually surrender.
But there's a difference between being captured and surrendering and being ordered to stop firing. That's a very different scenario, isn't it?
Absolutely, I think so. You know, because, like I say, it's been, we've been plagued with this. Okay, it's banter, but it gets through after 40 years where you get other servicemen and even civvies, you know, coming up to you and putting their hands up in front of you. And it just wears. But no, as far as we're concerned, we were just basically told to stop fighting. Rex Hunt was very, very strong on that. He used to come to all our reunions. We have an annual reunion the nearest Saturday to the 2nd of April every year. And at the 10th reunion in Plymouth, that's when Rex Hunt brought his book out. A journalist asked him, so he said, Sir Rex, what was it like when you told the Marines to surrender? And I actually saw him grab him by the throat and pushing him back. And he said, the Marines did not surrender. I told them to stop fighting. He was very adamant about that. Mm. Absolutely top guy, Rex Hunt. Really, really nice guy. But so we're told to just wait for the RGs to basically come and get us. And so we stay on the forest down in the hold. Jack Solis was really good, a very experienced seaman and a nice guy. And he came down and he asked if any of us wanted to leave anything with him, and he would look after it for us for the duration of whatever was to come. Mm. Nobody knew what was going to happen at that point. I certainly had a watch that I didn't want to lose. So a lot of us, you know, a year out there, we had money to burn, if you like, because nothing to spend it on out there. I bought myself a Rolex. Others had bought Rolexes or Seikos and, you know, nice watches, Omegas, etc. So I gave him my watch and I gave him my Swiss Army knife, which I didn't really want to lose either. Others gave him stuff, personal stuff. And true enough, he kept them throughout the war and we got, you know, got them all back afterwards.
Wow.
Yeah, really nice. And we're waiting. And something that's gone through my mind many years, one of my favourite films is Zulu. And there's a part in there where the Boer cavalry have come and ridden off. Obviously, the troopers at the Rorke's Drift think it was their relief column, but then they see them disappearing into the, you know, in a cloud of dust.
Yep.
And there's a trooper there that turns to the sergeant major and says, why? Why us? Why me? And the sergeant major turns around and says, because we're here, lad. Nobody else, just us. And that was our situation.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, not one of us turned around and said, why us? Why me? We just got on with it. We all thought we were going to be dead. None of us thought we'd ever survive an invasion. For our section, because obviously I didn't know what'd gone on around the rest of the town, and we hadn't taken any casualties, but we know we'd given them a bit of a bloody nose. We'd taken out a good number of RGs during our firefight. You know, certainly Benny had put the rounds down, and the others in the section. I'd reloaded my mags a few times. One of the things I always recall is when you're in training and you're on a range, you count your rounds. You know when to, you know, change your mag.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, when the shit's hitting the fan, you know, counting mags, counting rounds doesn't seem to work.
So
basically, every time there was a lull in the shooting, I took that opportunity to reload. So I did that several times. So I knew I always had pretty much a full magazine on. So we're waiting and waiting, and eventually an RG patrol is sent for us. And I think that's probably one of the most worrying times, mm-hmm. knowing that we'd just given them a hard time. We'd inflicted a lot of casualties on them. And the human rights in Argentina, certainly at that time, was obviously known not to be very good.
Yeah.
Lots of people disappearing. So it, we wouldn't have been at all surprised to have just been lined up and shot, you know. We expected the worst. But in the event, we were lined up and marched back towards Government House. The obviously infamous photos of my fellow Marines laying down face first in the dirt, being searched, etc. We were at least spared that indignity, but we had the indignity of being stopped by the flagpole whilst they took our flag down and raised theirs. Awful feeling seeing our flag come down. One little victory for us, though, is when they put their flag up, it was a huge flag, probably way too big for the flagpole. Whether that was the cause, I don't know. But in the event, as they were trying to raise their flag, it came down. It fluttered down, whether it hadn't been connected right or just whatever. So we gave a bit of a cheer, a rifle butt in the back for my troubles, and then marched off to the rest of the guys who were on a grass area beside Government House. And we got a cheer as we went in, and somebody started whistling "Always Look on the Bright Side of Life." Just taken up by everybody. Because, as I say, none of us knew what casualties we'd taken. And each time a section came in and they saw that there were no casualties, you know, that was a victory in itself. Because, you know, okay, it doesn't sound long. We've been fighting for around about 3 hours. In the grand scheme of things, that doesn't sound very long at all. But when you're actually in there fighting, that's an awful long time.
Yeah.
And anything could have happened in that time. The Government House had come under hail, you know, so many rounds fired at it. And, you know, not only there's a big thing made about stun grenades. Yes, stun grenades were thrown around then, but also high explosive ones were thrown. So there was all sorts going off. And we didn't take any casualties. This is just amazing. So we're sitting on the, you know, end up just sitting on the grass in very nice weather. These are the Falklands we're talking about in early April. But it was lovely. It was calm, sunny, and I was knackered.
That must have seemed quite surreal.
It did. It did. One of our section had actually managed to escape into the hills. We didn't know that at this point. They were at the entrance to the harbour, the Narrows. During the fight, they'd actually fired an 84 at one of the RG ships in the Sound. Got a bit of a salvo back for their troubles. So they did the infamous thing. One of the things Mike Norman had said, that if anybody was to make it, head for the hills, if you like, they would use the pass or the code phrase of "gone fishing." And Stephen York and his section did just that. They transmitted "gone fishing" and they headed off into the camp, where they managed to survive for a few days before, you know, handing themselves into the, that's another story anyway. So the Argies are a bit perplexed anyway, because they thought there's 44 in our detachment. They have obviously have all their intel, and our numbers just didn't add up. So one, they're not aware of Yorkie's section missing. They're not aware that we'd sent 9 people down on HMS Endurance to bolster them going down South Georgia. So they're completely unaware of what's going to happen the following day in South Georgia. Our numbers just didn't add up. We've also got a former Marine, Jim Fairfield, who'd married a Falkland Islander and was living out there. He'd left the Marines by this point. He'd rejoined the day before to fight at Government House. Fair play to him. Again, like the FIDF guys, he didn't have to, but he did. He decided to rejoin. And top chap he is as well. So, as I say, we're there on the grass. Another amusing incident, Jim Gerrard, Dave Gerrard, he said at one point, watch this. And he gets up and approaches this Argy guard. We've got a ring of guards around us. And I don't know how it's happened. And Jim Gerrard doesn't even know. And I've spoken to him recently about it. He takes from his pocket a white FOSS grenade in two pieces. He's got the grenade part in one hand and the handle and the detonator in the other. It's come apart. And he didn't do it. He reached into his pocket and found it like that. And he's gone to this Argentinian guard and handed this white FOSS in two pieces to him. And this Argy has just gone pale, taking it off of him and throwing it away, sort of thing. And
I'm not entirely surprised by that.
No. Like I say, Ginger is still unsure to this day how it's, broken, if you like. So, only he was our mechanic anyway, so breaking things was his good part.
So, what happened next, Ray? So, you obviously, you've been, captured, I suppose, is the best way to describe it.
We're told we're getting taken to Buenos Aires to be paraded through their streets. And we are flown out in a Hercules. This hurt a little bit as well because it was a Hercules that we'd sold to the Argies because it still had RAF markings inside it. We're flown to Comodoro Rivadavia, their naval and air base. And I think this is probably one of the most frightening times when we're there. We're taken off the Herc and led to another aircraft. And we're walking down this corridor of what I can only describe as Dad's Army. You've got a mixture of ages of these Argy guards, some in full combat, some in a combat jacket and jeans and a mixture of weapons, shotguns, and maybe my mind playing tricks on me, but I could have sworn there was a blunderbuss amongst one of them, or amongst them. I mean, they were so nervous. I mean, we had nothing on us. We just lost everything. We had no weapons. They must have known this, but I think they were so nervous that if one of us had said boo to them, they'd have just mowed us down. Mm. Anyway, we're taken to this other aircraft, still believing we're going to Buenos Aires, and we take off, and it's not until we land we realize we're actually in Uruguay, Montevideo again. So presumably things had gone on during that time with the governments. The Argies are still thinking at this point they can just get rid of us, and didn't anticipate Margaret Thatcher and an election coming up and the task force being formed up so quickly. So they've let us go. We land in Montevideo. Up until that point, I didn't have my passport, and I don't know how we ended up with these. Obviously, the boss had been given the passports when we left the Falklands. And I actually got a stamp in my passport, entry into Uruguay, which was actually the second entry stamp and no exits from Uruguay. Obviously, on the way down there, we've been taken out of Uruguay on the Endurance.
Yeah.
So now I've got two entry stamps to Uruguay. We get taken to a hotel, a five-star hotel, the Carrasco, I believe it was called. And by this time, it's early hours in the morning again. And we're taken straight into the restaurant where they place a massive T-bone steak in front of me. It was so big, there was nothing else could be on the plate, so it was a side plate of chips or salad and stuff. And they came around with a drinks trolley with half a dozen beers on the second tray with a load of soft drinks on the top. The next time they came around with a drinks trolley, it was all beers and a couple of soft drinks underneath. So they gathered that it wasn't the soft drinks we were after. So we managed to get our heads down. At this point, we're still in our combats and cam cream and everything's still on our face. So probably not really what a five-star hotel is normally used to checking in. And the following day, There's a bit of a debrief, and we're told that if we go to the bar, give them our room number and our name, and when we get back to the UK, we'll get a bill for whatever we use. We thought, okay, fine. And it didn't take too long before somebody realised that they weren't interested in our names and our room numbers. So things like FW Woolworths, WH Smith, BMS Boot, these sort of things came out for people's names and room numbers that probably didn't even exist.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Foreign Office did take care of all that, and none of us ever got a bill for anything in the end of it. But we were there for a couple of nights, and on the third day, the RAF have come out to collect us, to take us back to the UK via Ascension. Landed there for a quick refuel stop on Ascension Island before getting back to Bryce Norton. Now, in Uruguay, at the hotel, we were restricted to the hotel. We were there apparently under diplomatic immunity, so we were not allowed to go out. But every time any of us went to the windows opening to the front, or even to the front door, if any of us appeared, there was a crowd of Uruguayans there cheering us. Turns out they don't particularly like the Argies.
No.
And also, when we got taken from the hotel to the airport, there were, I'm sure there were thousands of Uruguayans lining the streets cheering us. We thought, okay, so the news has got back that we've done a reasonable job. So going on to the RAF aircraft, the DC-10, we were shocked when a newspaper, the Daily Mail, or Daily Fail, as I like to sort of call it now, it's got their shamed,
yeah,
the headline. You know, Royal Marines surrender, barely a shot fired. And we were in shock, I think, because we couldn't believe this. After what we'd just been through, and the British press were slating us, saying that we were shamed, we'd surrendered. That was the Sun. Their headline was surrender. And we were all gobsmacked. And so we thought, okay, well, when we get back to Bryce Norton, this will obviously be rectified. They'll know. Surely our own people will know. And we got back to Bryce Norton. We had the indignity of going through customs, and a customs officer said, have you anything to declare? Well, I'm not sure who it was, but probably some RAF officer dragged him away before he got lynched. Because, as I say, we'd just been, stripped of all our worldly belongings.
Yeah.
All our stuff was blown up. It was all in a repack box ready to come back, and the RGs blew that up at the Brook. But there's no greeting. There's no sort of welcome as such at Bryce Norton. You know, we were treated as if those headlines were true.
That must have hurt a lot.
It massively hurt, and it still does. Whilst Mike Norman's got a great book out, Falklands War, There and Back Again, another book, The First Casualty, have gone some way to doing this. And now Ben Fogel's thing, the producer of that, Craig McAlpine, done a great job with that, but didn't tell that much of our story, of us, although they have told the story about that we didn't surrender, like it's been portrayed. What we really want is, I want an acknowledgement from the MOD and the government that we did our job. Mm. We didn't just surrender. You know, Ben Fogel says it. We don't want medals. You know, we just want people to know what we did.
Yeah.
And still to this day, the MOD and the government won't acknowledge it.
Which is terrible, isn't it? But I think at least the program has come out. I mean, I know that's taken 40 years, isn't it? And there are books out there. So I think that's progress, but I still can't imagine how this must feel for you.
Yeah, and it's, as I say, you know, we're not alone. There's other people. The Irish. Have you heard of the film The Siege of Jadotville?
Yes.
The book as well. Yeah. Again, that took them in excess of 40 years to be acknowledged. The Australians, another great film, Danger Close, in Vietnam, another great, you know, incident. But why does it take these governments so long to acknowledge, you know, people that have fought for their lives? It just doesn't make sense. I don't understand it.
No, and serve their country. So I think one thing we can ask, if there's any listeners out there who have some influence over the government, please do get in touch with the government, I think. I just want to thank you for sharing that story, Ray, because I think it's an important one to tell. I didn't know a great deal about it when Chris Howe told me about it. So I did see the programme and we have chatted before about this, but I think it is really, really important that this story is told and shared. And I just want to thank you for taking the time to share it with me and our listeners.
Well, you're most welcome. And as I say, I just want people to know that don't believe everything you read in the press.
Is that the moral of the story? Fantastic.
I think so, because, you know, I can't ever forgive the Daily Mail or the Sun and all the other papers that, you know, did us wrong back then. Yeah, it's just, it still hurts, but it's getting better.
Good. That's progress. Thank you very much, Ray.
Okay, thank you.
Now, before Stephen might look back at the interview we've just heard, you may be interested to know that here at Company of Makers, we've got loads of online activities for veterans to get involved in. As well as this podcast, we've got online talks with inspiring guests, and we've got workshops where you can learn something new and meet like-minded people from the forces. To find out more, sign up for our newsletter and we'll send all the latest updates direct to your inbox. Just head over to companyofmakers.com/newsletter. Now back to Steve and Mike.
So Mike, as I promised, quite a story, don't you think?
What a story. Actually, what a collection of stories. Boy, has Ray got a good memory for anecdotes and dits, as they call them. I was fascinated throughout that, and some really good stuff to comment on.
I think there is, and yes, he has got a good memory, but I imagine it's probably seared into him, to be quite honest.
Yes, I think what came through your interview with him was this overriding hurt or sore that the press had portrayed the Royal Marines as having surrendered rather than being laid down their arms. And no one actually, from officialdom, actually correcting that. That feels like a sore that's been running for 40 years.
Yeah, and as he talks about, it hasn't really been corrected. There's been a book, but certainly in the sort of popular culture world, it hasn't been corrected until Ben Fogle's TV programme, which he obviously talks about.
Yeah, I thought that was very good, actually. And well, perhaps this podcast and the accompanying book for the Falklands 40 from Sama will help to correct it. But I will say, as someone that was serving at the time, albeit not down in the South Atlantic, that neither me nor any of my contemporaries ever thought the Royal Marines had surrendered. We knew that they'd been ordered to lay down their arms as part of a truce by the governor. And so it's not in my mindset, but I can understand from Ray's perspective that actually what the press portrayed, and he said, don't believe everything you read in the press, is what might be the common perception.
I mean, the headlines were dreadful, weren't they? I think, it, you know, surrender, shame, whatever it was, with that picture of them, obviously, at gunpoint. And let's be honest, it's not really in the Royal Marines code of conduct, is it, surrender?
If anyone's ever met a Royal Marine and suggested the word of surrender, they need to run very fast in the opposite direction. It isn't part of their state of mind. They're one of our most, if not our most elite, you know, land operating forces from the sea, and they've got a fantastic history, and no one should ever doubt their resolve to do whatever it takes.
No, I'll leave that to someone else to tell some of a Royal Marine that. Thank you very much. But what did you think of the rest of what he had to say?
as I said before, fascinating. I think his attention to detail and memory of all these little mini stories within the overall context of a 3-hour battle to try and defend waves of Argentinian troops against, I think he said, 64 Royal Marines, was astonishing. And they took no casualties in that 3 hours, which is unbelievable, really. I love the bit about them told to make their dispositions accordingly, no help coming. I thought that was classic British, you know, stiff upper lip type stuff. But actually, if you drill down to it, that is actually how the British forces work very well. That it's called mission command, and it's telling people to do what they think is best in the circumstances, because people further back haven't got the context of where the enemy are and what's happening. So actually making your dispositions accordingly is actually quite sensible.
I'll take your word for it, but I will use that expression again. I quite like it.
I mean, there were some lovely stories. I loved the one about the gap in the fence where he did his Hollywood stunt. You know, there was bullets raining around him. He saw a gap in the fence. He said in his mind's eye, he went through the gap, did a roll, and came up firing. And it was only a few years later, or many years later, that the real story emerged that he actually took the fence out when he tried to go through the gap. But never spoil the dit with the truth, I always say.
No, you wouldn't want the truth to get in the way of a good story, would you? So I think that's a theme that's going to come up, isn't it? Because he's talked about how being at reunions and speaking to his comrades in arms, that you kind of start filling in the gaps of what happened. It's kind of like a collective memory, isn't it?
It is, and I actually think, and this comes out in some of the other podcast interviewees as well, is that when the adrenaline is rushing, actually what you remember may not be what actually occurred, because your brain goes into protective mode to protect you against, that's what adrenaline does. And so I think there's an element there of actually, you know, you think you've done something, but actually the truth is something completely different. And it's not that you're deceiving yourself, it's just adrenaline alters the way you think.
Absolutely. But also, it demonstrates the value of reunions, I think, to fill in those gaps.
And also the value of comradeship that reunions bring. Do you say that actually there are, you know, we know that the Falklands created a number of PTSD sufferers. And it's things like reunions that where people realise they're not on their own, that there are other people in similar circumstances and they can support each other. That's what helps, you know, tackle these type of situations. Another thing I picked up on was the psychology of the green berry. And if you know any Royal Marines, you'll know how important the green berry is to them, and the award of the green berry at the end of their training is a milestone. It's in the submarine service, we get our dolphins when we become a qualified submariner, and it has a similar effect. In the Royal Marines, the green lit, the green berry, is everything. And actually, although it offers no protection, psychologically, he felt much better wearing it, and he probably acted, he probably was a better, you know, Marine as a result of, you know, that psychology, I think.
Yeah, and as we're recording this, there's the TV series talking about the commando ethos in the Royal Marines, isn't it? And acquiring the green lid, as you put it. And I thought it's quite interesting when one young lad says, that can be never taken away from me if you achieve it. That bond that has, achieving the green lid.
Completely agree with that. One of the other things I got from his interview was a special sense of humour. I mean, even at university, with bullets raining down and, you know, odds of 60 against thousands, he still retained a sense of humour throughout that. And he describes the bullet holes in the fence, his fence as he now calls it, he was lying flat down and they appeared just above where his head would have been if he'd put his head up. And he went back in 2015 and found that fence, his fence, and saw, blimey, that wasn't far away from me not making it.
Yeah, again, that features on the Ben Fogel program where they actually show the bullet hole and Ben Fogel kind of lies down, and it, you know, it probably gave him another parting in his hair, put it that way.
Yeah. So let's go on to what probably is the main thing to talk about, which is this sore that's been festering for 40 years about what happened at the end of that engagement. You know, they'd been fighting for 3 hours. They were outnumbered hundreds to one. Helicopters appeared, which, you know, a helicopter against individuals is not fun. They couldn't cross the river because the engine wouldn't work. And then they got told to lay down their arms and stop fighting because a truce had been made. And that was ordered by the governor, Rex Hunt. And they did what they were told to do. I think if they hadn't been told that, they would have kept on fighting. That is the Royal Marine ethos. But they are horrified by the way it was portrayed, particularly by the British press, as a surrender when it wasn't. And if we can do anything, Steve, to right that, then we should. It wasn't a surrender. They were ordered to lay down their arms, and Royal Marines don't know what the word surrender means.
Absolutely. So, you know, it was palpable, the kind of the anguish this was causing him, I think, and has caused him over the last 40 years. But I think, you know, I think there is an opportunity with the 40th commemorations of the Falklands War to retell that story correctly.
Yeah. And perhaps we can be part of that. So call out to anyone listening. If you are able to try and help set the record straight, then you know what to do.
Yeah, share this podcast with all your friends.
I think that's about it. I mean, unbelievable. It doesn't really even touch how much bravery and courage was required to do what he did and do it unthinkingly. So, you know, one hopes that this will, you know, this is all part of helping him with what has been hurting for the last 40 years. But also his story, he's probably not told it in any sort of outside of reunions and pubs. He's probably not told it to a wider audience. So let's hope a lot of people listen to this. And of course, it will appear in the book as well.
Yeah, I think also it's, you know, for the rest of Naval Party 8901, I'm sure they all have harboured similar feelings. So for all of them, really, not just for Ray, and I'm sure he would appreciate that. But I think there's one other point. If there was any doubt that the Falkland Islanders are British, I think the moment when he describes the, do you want a cup of tea whilst they were in the middle of a firefight, is proof enough in my book.
Yeah, absolutely. That is typical Royal Marine humour, actually. Well, you also, there was that story about them ordering a civilian to get out of the way. And he said, and I think he said something like, they said, get off the road. And he said, I don't know about you lot, but some of us have got some work to do.
Exactly. So don't want to be late for work. But yes, I think that just kind of goes to illustrate, doesn't it, as well, the way humour and the most kind of ridiculous things can happen in the most dangerous of situations, and how retelling those stories brings it to life. And I think to a degree, the value of actually what they have done, because, you know, it's very important that, you know, what they've achieved.
So here's to you, Naval Party 8901, Class of 82, the Royal Marine Detachment at the time of the Argentine invasion on the 2nd of April. You were ordered to lay down your arms. There was no surrender.
I have nothing to add to that. Thank you very much, Mike.
You're welcome. Hi, it's Mike here again. So just to let you know, this podcast accompanies the stunning Falklands 40th commemorative book produced by theveteran.uk on behalf of the South Atlantic Medal Association, SAMA 82. And we'd like to say a really big thank you to both our funders for making this possible, namely theveteran.uk and SAMA. And if you'd like to buy a copy of the book, then please head to either theveteran.uk website or sama82.org.uk. Thanks for listening.
Before we finish, we'd love to hear from you. So if you've got any thoughts, suggestions, or even a bit of banter, just email us at podcast@companyofmakers.com. You never know, you might even get a mention. And don't forget to hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you. This podcast was produced by Rachel Owen, hosted by Mike Davis Marks, and me, recorded and edited by yours truly.
Company of Makers, podcast talks, workshops.